welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host of your favorite hebdomadal podcast. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd bear the pain of achromatopsia if I saw that you missed this week's show, Leadership for Strategic Execution. There's lots of talk about strategic planning, lots of time and money devoted to ambitious plans, which often sit on a shelf. It takes leadership to drive strategic execution. What does that leadership look like? Joe Pager walks us through with his experience from the corporate sector. On Tony's Take Two, Podcast Pleasantries, we're sponsored by Turn Two Communications, PR and content for nonprofits. Your story is their mission. Turn-2.co. It's my pleasure to welcome Joe Pager to Nonprofit Radio. He retired from the corporate CEO office. He grew revenues, profits, customers, and employees at three companies for private equity investors. He's been on the boards of the Pittsburgh Symphony and the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. And in Pittsburgh, it's Carnegie, not Carnegie. Now he's a board member for the St. James School in Hagerstown, Maryland, and the Trinity School for Ministry in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He was my fraternity pledge trainer at Pi Kappa Alpha at Carnegie Mellon University. Back then, he was Zip. You'll find him on LinkedIn. He's retired and a board member. Doesn't need to be anywhere else. Welcome to Nonprofit Radio, Zip.
Thanks, Tony.
It's good to have you. Real pleasure.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to be here. Tell me about this private equity investment firm work. What did that look like?
Sure. Yeah, that came in the latter half of my career. Before that, I was an executive at larger companies. But, you know, what private equity is all about, there's many different models, but the particular group of investors I worked for, they buy businesses and they grow them and then they sell them, right? Mm-hmm. So typically we buy from a founder, right? Someone who founded the business, who's ready to retire and would like to make some money off of the business. And usually their businesses, these were technology businesses that we could see tremendous upside to, right? So we do a lot of searching for those with tremendous upside. You know, founders are good guys, but they often are unidimensional. So we could add things like professional sales or new strategies, et cetera, and or maybe even combine them with other companies and grow them. So that's what I did for the last 12 to 15 years is in three different companies sequentially. We bought them, we grew them, as you said, in terms of revenue, customers, number of people. And then we sold them to larger companies for a nice profit. And it's very fun. You got to walk in every couple of years to a brand new business, try to figure out the market in the business and figure out how to grow it.
So were there potentials to make money that you were not sharing with your friend, Tony Martinetti at the time? Was there like insider information that you could have snuck to me? Was there a way for me to make some money off these three?
All of the information is inside because they're private companies. So there's no public listing of the companies.
They're strictly privately held.
All right. Yeah, they're owned entirely by the investors. So yeah, there was no opportunity for you to make money unless you'd come and work for us, in which case then, yeah, you could have made some money.
Okay, well, we're going to find out what that would have looked like if I had indeed been working with you. All right, so you've got some ideas, and you know we've shared some concerns about, as I said in the intro, strategic plans. Lots of resources go into ambitious, maybe grandiose plans. We'll be kind and say ambitious, but execution, I think, and you've heard stories, and I think you've seen some too, and even in the corporate sector, not executed. Just kind of sitting around and not really seeing the change that was envisioned by the ambitious plan. So I'm guessing, you know, I mean, we should start with like vision and goals and right before we got to have vision to this before we can start to do the execution part.
That's right. Listen, we've all seen organizations, companies, nonprofits, maybe our own households, who knows, that have well-laid plans that never happen, right? They just never happen. And, you know, I learned this early in my career. I was once asked by a 9-year-old hockey player that I was coaching. He said, "Coach, when did you decide that you wanted to be a CEO?" And I thought about it for a few minutes and I said, "Might have been the first business meeting I ever sat in." Because I knew what we were talking about wasn't going to get done. It drove me out of my mind, right? So look, we've all been there. It starts, though, obviously, it starts with having a good plan, right? A plan that you believe in before you ever get to the execution part. So, you know, just real briefly, I'm sure you've had plenty of shows on how to build a strategy and a plan, and there's plenty of people out there doing that.
There are. We have, yes.
But a couple of criteria. One, you ought to be able to answer for me really quickly what you want that business, what you want your organization to look like 3 years from now. And you ought to be able to do that in 3 bullet points. I'll give you 5. If you go to 7, the last 2 better be really interesting.
Right? All right, 3 to 5.
So, you know, you have that vision, and that's a vision, all right? You know, you can have visions that are this, that, the other thing. No, just tell me, if I show up 3 years from now, what's going to be different about this place, right? And look, that's not easy. You got to think about it. You got to work hard on it. It's not a job necessarily just for the CEO. It's also a job for the board in a nonprofit. They need to share that vision responsibility.
Yeah.
And then below that, okay, that's the vision. That's what we're going to look like in 3 years from now. What are the 5 to 7 things we need to do? Those are the strategic initiatives, all right? Now here, the board has less of a role, in my opinion, and the CEO or the director in a nonprofit has a very large piece here, all right? They need to know their organization, where they need to take it. And then a third point, you know, so if you can clearly show me that, hey, we're going to do this and that's going to lead us to that, well, then you've got a good strategy, or at least a good strategic plan. Mm. There's another piece to it too, though, which is, and this is the tricky question that sometimes people trip up on. Tell me what you're not going to do. Tell me what people around here have been saying we ought to do, and you've decided I'm not doing it. All right. We're not going down that path.
Yeah.
So if you don't do that, you're going to run into problems with resource allocation and focus and people's commitment and engagement. So a really good strategy will tell you what you're not going to do, right? So, you know, that's all I'll say about strategic planning right now is all right. The output of that has to fit those 3 criteria.
All right. You emphasize believing in the plan because later on, we're going to talk about allocating resources around the plan. To the plan, taking resources away from those things we're not going to do anymore and putting them toward what we are going to do. So if you're going to do that with confidence, you got to believe in where you're headed.
Yeah, let me touch on that really quickly. It's a great point. I hear from people, we don't have the money to invest in this. Well, that either means that your plan is garbage, all right, that it doesn't really work mathematically, so you haven't really worked hard enough on your plan. I got an idea, right? I got an idea. And if we go do it, we'll grow our organization in this way. All right. Well, if you grow your organization in that way, you'll have the money to fund, you know, so either you don't believe that's actually going to happen, right? Or you don't actually buy into the idea.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, when somebody comes back to me and says, we don't have enough money to do this initiative, right? And you've thought, this is where I want to be in 3 years. This is critical to doing it. I've done the math. If I invest in it, it will happen and it will benefit the organization. If you come back and say, we don't have the money to do it, I'm just saying you don't understand the plan or you don't buy into it, one or the other. Right?
Yeah.
Right. Now, it could be that the plan is wrong, in which case, sharpen your pencil, go back to work.
All right, maybe you have something to talk about. But right, it's either belief in the plan or you believe in the plan or you don't.
Yeah, you're either resisting it or, yeah. But the plan says that we'll accomplish. That's the key. The plan says it will accomplish your goal. So how can you not find the investment to do that? You must, right?
Yeah. All right.
or you haven't worked out the right plan.
Point is, either you got the wrong plan or you don't believe in what you the plan that you do have. Okay.
Exactly.
What about the board? You mentioned the board's role in the vision, but not so much in the tactics we're going to use to get there. What about the interfering board or even board member or a couple of members? Maybe it's not the full board, but a lot of times it doesn't matter. What about those interloping, interfering board members who do get involved in the tactics, the methods we're gonna use to execute?
Yeah. So for the record, very clearly, I've been on four very good boards that you listed earlier.
Four perfect boards.
And we don't have that issue anywhere.
Yes.
Look, a board board of trustees for a school, all right, or a private education institution, they are responsible for preserving the vision and the values, and defining the vision and the values of that school. That's what they're there for, right? They're responsible for hiring the person to get them to that vision. That person needs to create the strategy with a lot of good input from the board, but it's their responsibility, whoever that leader is of the organization, CEO, headmaster, director, whatever their title, they're responsible for that. That's their job. That's what you should have hired, right? Is somebody, because the board will never have the day-to-day feel for the business that that person does, right? Because they only meet quarterly. So if you have an interfering board member, I would argue that you have a governance problem and a strategic problem, not necessarily a person problem, although it may well be a person problem as well. And I'd recommend that you go buy any number of good books of how to set up good boards and go fix your board, right?
All right.
You cannot, now listen, there's people who can help, right? There's people with contacts, there's people with experience, there's, and absolutely, you know, tap into them. But ultimately, the head of that organization is responsible for running that organization.
It's got to be the CEO. Yeah.
Got to be.
Yeah. All right. You got some sort of steps or, you know, some, a pathway to strategic execution. And not surprising, lots of folks say this, we're starting with what we're going to measure.
Yeah.
Metrics. Yeah. What's your advice around here?
So a couple of things. Let me back up just a half a step and talk about something that's near and dear to my heart called, I'm stealing this from, I was trained as a Baldrige examiner. That term probably doesn't mean many things to people.
Yeah, we got jargon jail on nonprofit radio. And you just committed an offense. Baldrige examiner.
Folks that are younger than you and I would never even have heard of it. But it's an old quality thing, sort of like Six Sigma. And the idea was, it was run by the U.S. federal government. It was quite a good program. And there was a set of criteria for a business. And you would examine the business against these criteria, and you could potentially win a Baldrige Award, which was a very big deal. Companies like Motorola paved the way.
Oh, Malcolm Baldrige.
Absolutely. Malcolm Baldrige was the Secretary of Commerce under Ronald Reagan.
Okay.
I believe he died in a horse accident, and they named this thing after him. All right, so Congress.
A bizarre polo accident.
Yeah, no, it was more like Western rodeo stuff.
Oh,
he was a tough guy.
That's so civilized. All right.
But the horse was tougher.
Yeah.
In any case, so it's named after him. He was part of the driving force, and his death actually helped get it passed. In any case, long story, they had this method of when you examine a business, you find out, right, do they have a plan, right? What result is it that they're trying to improve? Let's say they're trying to improve market share. Right? Do they have a plan to improve market share? Right? And you'd say, look at their plans. They'd have to produce one. And if they had a plan, they would get sort of a 10% of the total score, right? And then you would look at how do you measure it? And they'd look at the result. And if you were measuring the result, you might get another 20%, right? But 70% of the score on that was associated with prove to me you're actually executing the plan. Show me that you've actually done it. All right. Because so many people, I'll use a sporting analogy here. So many companies and so many organizations have the plan and they look at the results. And if the results go bad, they go, the plan was wrong. They never check to see whether they actually implemented the plan correctly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a sporting analogy, a team goes out, a hockey team goes out to play on the ice. And the coaches say, this is the system we're going to use. And they go out and they lose the game. And of course, winning or losing was the metric. They come back in and say, we lost, we're changing our system. No one would ever do that. They'd go, let's look at the video and see whether we actually use the system, right?
Yeah.
And this is a big thing that happens in businesses and other organizations. That middle step is what I call strategic execution. And I'm telling you, it is more rare than you think.
Right. And you've seen this on the corporate side as well. This is
absolutely
revelation that you've only seen on the not-for-profit side. Yeah.
Over and over again.
The execution. All right. And that we were talking earlier, and you've made the point that that leads a lot of CEOs to create reorganization.
Yeah.
So they can say they've done something. I mean, their LinkedIn profile is now more robust. They reorganized around something.
Yeah, you see it a lot. I don't mean to bash large companies, but because large companies are much more difficult beasts, right? But very large companies do this all the time. They say that their strategy is to reorganize something. And yes, it makes them feel good because they can check off a box that they indeed reorganized. They laid off some people here. They put somebody new in charge here. They restructured, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to be too negative, but golly, I don't know what that gets done. And I work.
Right, there's a lot of wasted reorganization.
And the issues, the things that need to be changed, the things that need to be executed, no pun intended, right?
Yeah.
Are what you're doing, right? And where you're focused, right? It's not who's leading it. And I mean, it is who's leading it, but it's not entirely who's leading it. And so it's just to avoid, listen, all of this is hard work. Right. The reason I did it was because if I didn't, I'd lose my job. These investors, you know, they weren't interested in people who weren't actually growing the company. Right. I mean, you know, you could have as many board meetings where you said all the right things and had the pretty slides as you wanted. If the company wasn't growing, it wasn't your job anymore. Right. And by the way, very, very few people in my position work for the same investors twice. They usually do one, and then they find a different set. And I'm the only person who's worked for this set of investors three times, okay, on three different companies. So it's all about finding that thing that has to happen to grow the company and then making sure it gets executed. That's why I have sort of a particular affinity or sensitivity to this issue.
But so much of this is moving people. You know, people don't like change. I don't care how much they're paid. They're still human beings. I don't care how long they've been there. You know, of course, the longer, the more difficult to change. But, you know, people are resistant to change. You talk about, you know, the family, you know, people don't like to move. People don't like to change jobs. People don't like to change within their jobs. People don't like to have to go to a different supermarket in the middle of a pandemic. People don't like not being able to go out and have dinner with friends in a pandemic. People don't like change. But so much of what we're talking about is driving change. You're driving change in a company. That's driving change among a bunch of people. Yeah. That's what the company's made of. It's got assets. It's got hard assets. And it's got people. And the hard assets are easy to move around. You can ship those. You can sell these. You can acquire some. But moving the freaking people, that's what we're talking about. Moving people to change that they don't like.
It is. And I would imagine that it's more difficult in the nonprofit sector than it is in the corporate sector. And the reason I would say that is because in the corporate sector, there's a big forcing function called competition, right? And investors, and you have to make the numbers. So if you don't change, you know, you go away quickly. And so let me talk a little bit then about about what I see, about how you do strategic execution, because it is exactly that. It's about changing the people.
It's time for a break. Turn to communications. The Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. You want to be in papers like that? What about CBS Market Watch, the Chronicle of Philanthropy? Turn 2 has the relationships with these outlets and lots of others like them. They're known in the industry so that when the outlets are looking for experts on charitable giving or nonprofit trends or philanthropy, they call Turn 2. Turn 2 calls you. You know that because you're their client. They're going to call you. They can help you get the exposure, the media that you're looking for. Relationships, right? It's all about leveraging relationships. They've got them. Turn-2.co. Now back to leadership for strategic execution. All right. Yeah. Because I'm on a rant here about moving people to change. Before we get to metrics and resource allocation, you know, you got to move people. You got to motivate people positively or negatively, I suppose. But you got to move people. How do you get people to do things that they don't want to do?
I used to tell this story, really in big settings, small settings everywhere. I said, you know, you get on the airplane, you read in the airplane magazine, and they're interviewing some executive, and a question answer thing, and you're going through it, and at some point they go, what's the secret? And the executive goes, it's all about the people. And you go, oh crap, like everybody gives that answer. Really, again? And then I thought about it for a while and I'm like, gosh, it really is all about the people. It's right. It's a boring answer and it is the answer. Listen, here's how you get people to change.
Yeah. And
one of the things I loved about my career was I would walk into a company that had not accomplished something for a long time. And they had many things in front of them that they could accomplish. And we would go accomplish it. And people would go, how did that happen? And they'd feel good about it. And they'd have I want to give them a story to tell their grandkids when they're sitting in their rocking chair on their front porch, right? About business. Most people go through their business careers going, yeah, there's that over there. And then all the stuff I like over here. Right? And I want to give them something they like from their job. So look, how do you change? How do you get people?
Yeah. Before the first milestone, right? Before the first home run that this company has now achieved something that it could have achieved 10 years earlier, but you know, there's a bit of a founder syndrome and they were unidimensional, as you said. And so
how do you get them bought in? How do you
Before that first home run, how do you get some momentum going? How do you get interest?
Exactly. So look,
what do you say?
Well, what you do is this. First, you got to find that strategy. That's all important. And you got to find the plans. And then you must communicate very clearly, okay? You must communicate. And look, there's some pieces to that communication. First of all, I heard a long time ago, and I always strive to do this, you should speak at an eighth grade level, okay? You have to understand.
Talking to a bunch of engineers at a tech company, MBAs, your CFO, yeah?
And your operations team, right? Who are hourly workers, right? Yeah. So you've got a range. You've got a range in there. Speak at the eighth grade level. Secondly, make sure what you're saying is a story. All right? I'll go back to coaching little kids in hockey. I could go up there.
Hockey. It's your affinity for hockey is obviously coming out. Yes. Yes.
I want
you to know for listeners, because you won't be able to see video. This is this the sound of this. That's me flipping pages through my Pi Kappa Alpha pledge book. So there's lots of history in these pages. Joseph Stephen Pager from Meriden, Connecticut.
There you go.
And hockey is prominent on your page.
And it remains so.
This would be from 1980. So, I still have this from 1980.
Throughout my career.
For hockey is
but here's the deal. I could sit in front of a group of 15-year-olds. And I could show them all the X's and O's on a whiteboard and say, this is what we're going to do today. That's what we're going to do today. Blah, 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 blah. And they'd all be fidgeting and not paying attention, or like 15-year-olds do. They'd be staring at the floor, you know, blah, 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 blah. Then, but if I came in and said, let me tell you about a game I played in college. and what happened, their eyes would be on me. They'd be lifted up from the floor. We respond to stories, okay? People learn from stories. They don't learn from textbooks, right? They learn from stories. This is what you must do as a leader. You must tell the future story, okay? You must say, here are the great things we're going to do for our community and our space. Here's what we're doing today. Here's how that's going to change and be even better 3 years from now. Now, how are we going to get there? We're going to do these three things, okay? And it's going to feel a little different to you, but we're going to do these three things. And do you know how many people are going to buy into that the first time you tell them? Two. if there's 50 people in the room, three.
You got two allies you can leverage.
So what do you got to do? You've got to tell them that same story over and over again. And person by person, as they ask questions, and your job is over the next 6 to 9 months to reduce it to the impact on them as an individual and how they can contribute and how they can be a piece of it. This communication aspect is very important. What I see executives do is they think, well, I said that last time, I'm going to change it this time. No, you don't understand.
Yeah.
No, just because they heard it once from your lips, they don't believe it and they probably don't remember it. Right. You've got to keep saying it. You got to keep saying it. Then, of course, you've got to lead by example, right? Now you're in a position, this will go back sort of into metrics and resource allocation. You're in a position to make a bunch of decisions and to make them in front of everybody. They have to be consistent with that vision you're describing. So you might decide to move resources from a status quo kind of a project to the new project. And you would explain it that way, even if they're upset. You might decide to set certain metrics and review those metrics on a monthly or quarterly basis. Really, the metrics that you set, and everybody knows there's a billion metrics for everything. You got to pick the two or three that make a difference to your strategy and just work on those. If somebody wants to know some other thing, here's an example, software company. Now, last software company I ran, we would sell the software. Then we would install it for the customer and run it for them. We'd call that activating it. And then we would run it for them. And if they were satisfied all the time, we would make a lot of money because they would never leave us, right? So the sale part we call booking, the middle part we call activating, the third part we call just satisfying. And I just reduced it to that. We only have one mission here: book, activate, satisfy. All of you are involved in one of those three, okay? Now let's talk about how you're involved and what you can do and get the managers in there talking. This is 400 people. But that became our mantra: book, activate, satisfy. Well, where's gross margin in that? Where's cost savings? Yeah. We have losses. Where's entering a new market? Well, we have stuff to do there too. But it was secondary to those three things. If you did those three things, you didn't have to, what I used to say, if you do those three things, don't you worry about profitability. Like a knife through butter will be profitable, I guarantee it, right? And you don't even need to see the profitability. So you got to make it simple. You got to make it pithy. You got to make it catching. You've got to say it over and over and over again. And if you do that for 6 months of those 50 people in your organization, you'll have 48 of them. And then there's going to be two, right?
Yeah, the recalcitrants.
Yeah, they're not going to go. You need to go have a conversation. You need to do your job as a leader. And look, the conversation's not mean. The conversation is this. We're a team. Everybody always says, I'm all in. It's all about team. Well, we're a team. And now we're going to put our money where our mouth is. All right? The team has decided to go in this direction. I understand that you've been here for a long time and that you did things a certain way and all that stuff. I get it. And it's all valid. And we've heard it, but we've decided as a team to go in another direction. I need you to come back and see me tomorrow come back tomorrow morning or tomorrow afternoon, stop by my office and just tell me, can you come with us? And if you can't, then let's talk about how to separate our paths gracefully, right? It's not a threat, you know, but it is necessary. You can't have one guy on a professional sports team saying, I don't agree with the system. You just can't. You're never going to win anything, right? And this is a very reasonable approach. I mean, and quite frankly, every time I've had this conversation, they've come the next morning and said, I'm in. Now, some of them might have come and said, well, I'm scared now, and so I'm in. Others, I think, really went home and went, what am I doing? Why am I so against this? Why can't I just go along with it, right? Yeah. And they jump in and they become productive that afternoon, right? And in a couple of cases, they've come back and said, you know what? I really like the company that was here before you got here, Joe, and I'm not bought into this one. So how can I leave gracefully? Can I have a month to find, you know? Yeah, you can. Absolutely. Just you say nice things about me, I'll say nice things about you. And let's do it. So,
right.
So that's, and by the way,
it's good.
Those two recalcitrants is what you call them.
Yeah.
They can be a huge issue. So if they exist, you must take action or you're not going to get there, because they will continue to needle.
They're like a cancer. They're growing. They're trying to find. They're trying to grow their tribe, right? They're trying to grow their anti-team.
But you do it. You do it with complete and genuine respect. They have an opinion. You have an opinion. You don't agree. There's no reason to be Washington-esque with each other.
Okay. No, you said gracefully. No, I mean, you're professionals, and you're right. You don't agree. You don't agree on the future of the company that the team has. That a team has elected to pursue. There's no point in, you know, there's no point in you hanging around. You're unhappy. It's going to hurt the team.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's separate gracefully. I like gracefully. You don't hear that in business tour. Gracefully. Let's do it gracefully.
Yeah.
But Joe, let me ask you, do you have interest in helping nonprofits with all this leadership and strategic execution that we're talking about?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. If a nonprofit is interested in learning more about this, I can certainly help them on a consulting basis, help them get set up and help them get executing on their initiatives. I could even help them develop the initiatives if that's what they so desire. But I'd very much be interested in helping nonprofits achieve their results, basically.
Yeah. Okay. And so folks can get you on LinkedIn.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just look me up on LinkedIn. Last name is spelled P-A-J-E-R.
You have a little story about sales compensation. it relates to metrics. What before we move on from metrics, we digress, but we're moving around. This is good. This is excellent. This is not just good. This is excellent leadership advice. You got the sales comp story.
Yeah. So one of the aspects of metrics, of choosing the proper metrics, is that, you know, you actually have to be able to measure the thing, right? So if you say, I want to measure, you know, let's say I'm a food bank and I want to measure somebody's improving nutrition as a result of my efforts. Well, that's probably not measurable. Okay. I mean, maybe it is, but, you know, it's probably difficult to track that person, the individual that you gave the food to. And even more so, I would question your statistics as whether you could actually correlate your effort to his improving nutrition if it improved. But that's something that's sort of undoable. There's others, though, that you want to measure how many new people you reached through a program. And people say, well, we don't track that, so you can't use that as a metric. But, you know, so every company I've gone into, the sales compensation plan, right? We believe that salespeople are motivated by making more money. Yet many executives I know have no idea what their Salesforce is, how their Salesforce's compensation plan works. That's crazy, right? So every company, and of course, what we care about is growing. So of course, it's important to us to have the right sales compensation plan, right? So that we can drive the growth. So every company, I've gone in and redesigned the sales compensation plan. It's actually something that I've gotten quite good at. And, you know, it's an area of expertise, and I've done it pretty much myself, right? And every time finance has told me, oh, we could never track this. We could never do this. We could never, this is just what we've never done. And in two of the three cases, I got up after about an hour's worth of discussion. I got up. I said, I hear everything you're saying. You must make it happen. We'll talk again when you have a plan to make it happen. Not before. Okay. Basically, I said, do it, right? And you just have to, because they'll find a million reasons not to, right? So that is my sales compensation story. So you have to, sometimes the and sometimes in that conversation on metrics, by the way, what they're really saying is it's not automated. They're saying it's not automated. We have to do this manually.
Right, it's going to be hard for us to achieve it, or hard for us to measure it. Not impossible. It's just
right.
It's just right. Hard. Okay.
And this is another little thing that I've learned. Some of the people who work for me call these pagerisms. But if you want to get something automated, make the people do it manually. they'll find a way to automate it, and it has the benefit of automating it correctly. Because if they start out with automation, they don't really know what they want yet, right? They don't know the ins and outs of what they're doing. So, yeah.
Okay. You say the number one resource, number one job of a chief executive is resource allocation.
You bet.
We were touching on this before. You got moving things away from what you don't want to be and into what you do want to be. What else? You're moving people now. This is some of that change. Some people are going to be into, different team, a different activity, a different way of doing their old activity. That's more of the change. So, you know, we talked some about that, but what's your advice around moving resources around?
Well, I think, resource allocation is fundamentally getting the right people, number one, and the right number of people, number two. And this can be very tricky, especially with new growth initiatives to the company. So in all three companies, we expanded globally, right? So we didn't have anybody. So we had to get the right people in each country a long way away to do this correctly. We needed the right number of people in each of those countries. So expanding globally is one way. But another way might be to expand in nonprofit terms, expand your services, right? Say, I don't want to do just this. I can also do this while I have the client in front of me. So I can do even more good for the client by expanding my services. Mm. Well, do you have anybody in your organization who understands that new service the way they need to, right? And if not, you need to go outside the organization. Do you have the right number of people to expand that new service? Okay. Do I have the right number of people offering the current service? Okay. Because there's it's a little bit of a hill, and then it flattens out after there's a peak and then a flattened out thing when you introduce something new. Mm-hmm. So you may have introduced a new service 3 years ago, and you may still be staffed at your peak, and you don't need to be, right? You could reallocate some of those resources to the new service. These are the key discussions you have to have. The big one for me, did we talked about believing in the plan?
That's wrapped up in that. If you're going to move resources around, you got to believe in what you're moving them toward.
Right. You just have to believe that plan is going to work. Right. And then you'll be willing to commit. Take another example. You're a nonprofit and you decide, that development is critical to you, okay? Let's say you're a small educational facility and you just got to build the endowment, right? Or, you know, what's happening to small private schools is going to happen to you, right? You're not going to have the funds to build out the right buildings, et cetera. So you got to build the endowment. And your three-year plan is to add $10 million to the endowment, right? And look, you've had this development guy, he knows everybody, but he hasn't really grown anything in years, okay? All right, so you decide, okay, well, maybe I move him someplace, maybe he's going to retire, maybe I just need a new development person, okay, and he's got to go away. Fine. You go out to get the new development person, and you say, well, I don't want to spend more than $50,000 a year on this person, right? And somebody who's $75,000 comes along, right? But at a much higher skill set. No, I didn't say $150,000, but $75,000. Well, you ought to do the work rather than just say that we're all about saving money because we're trying to help our clients. You ought to do the work to say, what would this guy get me that the other guy wouldn't get me? And how quickly will I get that $25,000 a year back, right? I mean, you know, it can't always be about being the lowest cost provider of these services. You may well find that if you hire and spend that extra $25,000, that you're going to grow your endowment by even more, right? And you'll be able to provide even more dormitories or even better, et cetera, right?
And this goes back again, believing in the plan. And as you said earlier, you said early on, if you don't have the money for the plan, then you haven't thought through your plan adequately, because you picked an aspirational plan that you can't afford to execute, and you can't even do the fundraising to raise the extra money because it's too astronomical. So you've got the wrong plan.
That's exactly right. You know where this comes up a lot is in building buildings. It's almost always the case that you know, you think a building costs less than what it's going to cost, right? Yeah. And it actually, you think it'll deliver less value than it actually delivers, right? Certain buildings. I mean, you know, if you're building an administration building, right? But a new sports center at a boarding school or a conference center at a place like the Trinity School for Ministry.
Yeah.
These things are going to have much more impact than what you're projecting. So think about them carefully and take the risk. Take the risk.
It's time for Tony's Take Two. Podcast pleasantries. You remember those? The podcast audience. Oh my. Oh, so loyal. If you've been listening for a while, you'll remember that I used to do live listener love, affiliate affections, and podcast pleasantries. Well, the first of those to go away was the affiliate affections when I ended the affiliate program. That was, we had a family of about 15, maybe 20 AM and FM stations throughout the country that were carrying nonprofit radio in their weekly schedules. But it wasn't really scaling. And it constrained us in terms of how exactly minutes and seconds, how long a show needed to be. So I ended that. And the live audience, the live listener love, you know, that ended with the pandemic. I no longer go to the New York City studio, no longer with Sam. Sam is still there at NYC, no, Talk. Talkradio.nyc. That's him. That's that network, talkradio.nyc. It's Talking Alternative. So Sam is still there, but I ended with him because of the pandemic. So, of course, no more live listener love. And now working through Zoom and Audacity, it's the podcast audience. The pleasantries go out. You're the last remaining audience. When I see, if I cast you off, that's the end. What do you call a podcaster that nobody listens to? A guy talking to himself in a closet? A guy whispering to himself? Now, so the pleasantries go out. The pleasantries remain. The podcast pleasantries. whatever time you're listening, however we fit, whether you're painting your house, doing the dishes, commuting. There's less commuting going on, I realize that, but there's still some commuting going on. Maybe you're driving to the store, who knows. However Nonprofit Radio fits into your schedule. Maybe binge watching, binge listening on Sundays, who knows. However it fits in, the pleasantries go out to you, our loyal podcast audience. Still there, over 13,000 each week. Pleasantries. Pleasantries to you, podcaster, podcast listener, pleasantries. And that is Tony's Take Two. We've got buttloads, or buku, that's what we've got. We've got buku buttloads, more time for leadership, for strategic execution with Joe Pager. And communications, you already said, you know, speak at an eighth grade level. I guess this is another Pagerism about the number of times you should communicate and how many people you're going to reach.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you want to reach people, communicate four times as much as you think you need to, and you'll get to half the people you hoped. So just, I cannot stress it enough. Like, consistency, eighth grade level, frequency, walk the talk. Just listen, the people are going to deliver the plan. You've just got to change them.
The work is getting done, you know, without you looking over everybody's shoulders. You talk about a 400-person organization. I don't care if it's a 4 or 8-person organization. The work is still getting done while the CEO is not looking.
Right.
They're off somewhere.
That's another, I'm glad you brought that up. That is another very important part of communication. I'll do it in an engineering way for you, okay? Engineers, software engineers particularly, you know, they work in the dark and they work late at night and they work alone.
Like the nerds that we knew at Carnegie Mellon.
You bet.
Neither one of us was in computer science, but we saw them that in the winter they were walking barefoot or in flip-flops.
Absolutely.
They were always a couple of steps out of sync, but you know, they're now leading professors at MIT or they're founders of Google or Amazon from the 1980s. Yeah.
They prefer to work alone. They prefer to work in the dark. Okay, great. That's an overgeneralization to all my software friends, but you probably agree. And they're programming. They're building your product, right? So now, how do you guide their innovation? They're making decisions alone in the dark at 3 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, how do you guide their decision? Well, it's going to come down to, did I give them a vision that they can work within, right? So book, activate, satisfy, right? I said satisfy, right? And we've had discussion, you know, so with book, activate, satisfy, you might hold, after you announce the grand theme, you might hold a session just on book, just on activate, just on satisfy, right? To explore it at even greater depth. Eventually, this guy figures out, you know, because we're talking about satisfying so much, right? That when a client using his software puts the wrong inventory in, or when the inventory isn't up to date, the software doesn't work as well, and it doesn't create as much value as the customer would like. And he comes up with a way to automatically grab their inventory at 3 a.m. when no one else is around, but he wouldn't have known it if you hadn't have done all that work communicating it, right? He might have come up with a way to make it cost less, right? Which might have been welcome. Might be welcome. When you're growing a company, I never worry about the cost. Okay. It's like if the growth plans work, the costs will never catch up. All right, because we'll be growing too fast. Okay. So, you know, that's the difference, is what are these people thinking when they're on the front line? In a nonprofit example, right? Let's say you're a food bank that wants to work more with partnerships, okay? And your local church has a food bank that could partner with the big food bank, right? But you know that in that food bank, the intention of forming those partnerships is to reach people you're not currently reaching, right? Which is very different than an intent of to reach people more effectively using a local organization or more efficiently, right?
Okay, yeah, now you're talking about a new market.
Yeah, those are the two reasons you might do it. Well, if you know this person who runs a food bank at your church, you would now ask them, well, who are you reaching, and see if, you know, it's the same person already, right? Or et cetera, et cetera. So you can make a more intelligent decision at your level because you understand the vision, the strategy, what's important, what's being measured, and it's going over and over and over again.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about holding individuals accountable through through review, looking at the challenges that they're facing, what their personal plans are. Let's talk about that whole accountability review piece.
So couple of things. One, as the leader, you must be personally involved in the review and in the detail. And you must personally know the progress that's being made, okay? So you need to establish the metrics. Well, first of all, you need to do this in a regular timing kind of way. So you need a cadence, what I would call a management cadence.
Yeah. Right?
Now, with each initiative, there's a couple of choices. You could decide, I'm going to meet weekly, all right? So now you have a weekly meeting that's sort of independent of the nature of the initiative, but weekly we're getting together and we're talking about it. Okay, that's one way to do it. And for some initiatives, that's really good. Other initiatives are a little bit weirder though, right? Some actions, like the first actions might take a week, and the next action might take a month, right? Or 2 months. So you might want to have a meeting the first week and a meeting the next week to make sure you did everything from the first week. Or you might want to delay it for another 3 weeks. So there's something meaty in the meeting, right? Something's changed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I believe that I have so many quotes from this guy I used to work with. But one of them was personal embarrassment is the number one driver of human behavior. yeah. Now, we should not abuse that.
Okay? It's management by fear.
Yeah, we should not
fear abuse of embarrassment.
That.
Yeah.
But another way, if you flip that to the positive, personal recognition is also the number one driver of human behavior. So I believe in team meetings with everybody who's involved. All right. So that we can look at the metrics. What are the results? Okay, those are the results. That's 5 minutes, all right? Next most important question is, on this initiative, last week we said we were gonna do this, this, and this. Last meeting we said we're gonna do this, this, and this. We're gonna go around the room. Did you do it? That's the first question, yes or no, okay? Yes or no. I also have this plagiarism that we are not trying to be Washington here. We are not trying to create a culture of blame, okay? Because it's useless, and you can see that, right? Yeah. We're not just trying to figure out who to blame. No, we're trying to understand. So if you didn't do it, just say you didn't do it. Now, if you didn't do it for 6 weeks, I never yelled and I never swore in any meetings, but I've been told that I could make the air feel very heavy. So a little bit of tension is a good thing for the whole team. And if the person continues to not deliver, well, then it's a private conversation again.
You got to have that conversation, yeah.
But really, isn't it much better for them to feel accountable in front of the team than just accountable to you, right? And have the team say, come on, we got to get this done.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I can
need
see
you to do your part.
That's going to bring a team together. If folks are willing to open up and say, you know, we're not on radio, so I can say, no, I fucked up. I told you 2 weeks ago this was a priority, and I haven't made it a priority, and I will in the next 2 weeks. You know, if somebody can say that openly to their CEO and to their team, maybe even more so to the team, then it is a team.
Right.
Okay, this guy didn't pull his weight, or you know, she cut him a little short. Next week it might be me.
That's
but
right.
it's an environment that supports us and isn't beating us down. Now, but you like, you know, you say if it's 6 months or, you know, whatever, you know, then we have to go a different, different strategy. But that can bring a team together, that kind of openness, I think.
You are 100% correct. And the rest of the team appreciates it, right? So another important part of this cadence meeting is that you set the example for this, that you're inquisitive. You want to understand the problem. You want to help. Yeah. You're not there to go, you didn't do it, I move you to this side of my ledger. When you do it, you go back to the other side. No, I mean, that's fine. And then the other thing that's popular today is the stand-up meeting. We're going to do this all in 5 minutes. You don't understand anything in 5 minutes. That's appropriate for some meetings, but in this, what you're trying to find out is what's holding me back. Yeah. If you're leading an organization like I was leading, where if the company didn't grow, it was me, I was done, right? You very quickly, if you have half a brain at all, you're walking around every day trying to figure out what's going to prevent you from growing. Okay, that's all you care about, right? You're like, and every issue, a people issue, a customer issue, a operations issue, it all gets reduced to, is it going to prevent me from making my plan? And if it is, how are we going to solve it quickly so that it accelerates me towards that plan, right? So that's what you want everybody, understanding your behavior and your questions in those terms, and that we're all on the same team trying to do this. And what happens is, you're right, the team gels, the people want to finish by the meeting. You have to have the meetings, they're a forcing function. People do most of their work the night before the meeting.
Right.
That's okay with me. Okay. So, right. And you keep them open. And let me tell you, the people, you have all kinds of levels of people in this meeting. Anyone who can affect this is in this meeting. Okay. And what happens over time, if you set the right example, number one, the people at the bottom will come to you and they say, I so appreciate being in that meeting with you and watching you think through these problems. But your direct reports, the people who report directly to you, that those people report to, they'll start jumping into the meeting doing the same thing. So-and-so, Joe down at a low level says, I tried to get it done, but I couldn't because of this, right? In the first meeting, I'll go, okay, well, how are we going to fix that? In the third or fourth meeting, the person who reports to me will go, Joe, right after this meeting, come see me. We're going to fix that. And now I'm not on cruise control, but we're all together just trying to make this happen.
Not all plans are going to work, right?
No, absolutely not. I'm telling you that, tell you two things. One, I never walked into a company and said, you doofuses, you didn't know you should be doing this. Never walked in and created a new plan. Okay. What I did was I walked in there's this guy, Kenichi Omai. He's a Japanese guy who wrote something called The Mind of the Strategist. And I'd look at the situation and I'd try to break it into pieces, okay, into the logical pieces, and then work on each piece to see how I could make it better and then put them back together. Not all of them came back together. Some we put to the side. Others we made, you know, in any case, that's a little bit ethereal. But the plans that we followed always existed in the business before I got there. But with some modifications, we'd adopt them with some modifications.
Yeah.
And then we'd execute them.
But you're saying the plans were already there.
Sure, the ideas were already there.
That middle step wasn't getting done, the execution.
First company I went to had a product that they were going to introduce that they'd been talking about for 5 years. We introduced it in 13 months. I sat in the meetings. We had to introduce it. We had a new market we wanted to enter, and they just went round and round and round on whether it was the right market to enter. And so, you know, you can always find a reason not to do something.
Sure.
It's a lot easier to find reasons not to do something than it is to find reasons to. There's almost this mindset like, well, we got to find something that no one in the industry has ever thought of. Well, that's, good luck with that. That just never happens, right? No, you got to execute better than other companies. So, you know, we had this market we wanted to enter, and everybody was disproving why we could enter it. And at some point I just said, no, I think we can do it. Let's try it. And we went after it. And that company is thriving in that market today, right? The last software company that I ran, same thing. Here's a new market. We went after it. We're leading in it right now, right? But it was an idea that had been around forever. Oh, there was another market too, where they had actually convinced themselves there was no way to make any money in it. And we went.
It's that it's avoiding that scarcity mentality, and that, you know, it's a focus on how we can instead of why we can't.
That's
because
right.
It is always easier, much, much easier to find reasons why you can't do something.
And to
evaluate and then execute on a plan to do something. So yeah. I always say let's look at it how we can instead of why we can't.
Now that market, that's an interesting one. That market, I won't tell you too many of the details because it's active right now, but it's about half of their new business right now. Okay.
Yeah.
And I had to move 30% of the engineering resources in that company to focus on that new market. And they were already booked. You know, they would have told you they're booked 150%.
Right.
So, and did some things fall off the table in the status quo? You bet they did. We lived with it. We found ways around it, right? I mean, that's the point where, you see, as the leader, I can't walk away and say, figure it out.
Well, that's the belief in the plan.
No, I've got to be part of the team that figures it out, right? Yes, I'm still the leader. I'm not coming up with the solutions, but I'm asking the questions, right? What can we do? How can we do it? Tell me what we could, you know. Okay, well, I moved 35 people over there. You need one of them back or you can't get this done. Is that what you're telling me? Yeah. Move them this afternoon. I mean, you know, I moved 35. Guess where I got that number? Yeah. Out of the air. Right. Okay. But in some companies that question never gets asked. Oh, Joe moved them. We can't move them back. Yeah. Okay.
All right, Joe. Thank you. Joe Pager. A reminder that Joe Pager is available to consult with your nonprofit on everything we talked about: strategic execution, change management, leadership, fraternity pledge training. You can reach him on LinkedIn. Remember, it's Pager. Joe, thank you very much. It's good to
you're back.
Good to have this conversation. You shared some excellent ideas. Appreciate your wisdom. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Next week, corporate funding. If you missed any part of this week's show, I beseech you, find it at tonymartinetti.com. We're sponsored by Turn 2 Communications, PR and content for nonprofits. Your story is their mission. Turn-2.co. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. Mark Silverman is our web guy. And this music is by Scott Stein. Yeah. For that affirmation, Scotty. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.